south old front riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today, we will continue to read from Cowboy Up, Life Lessons from Lazy Bee by H. Allen Day. This was published in 2018 by Morgan James Publishing, based in New York. As you may recall, these are a series of brief reminiscences from Allen Day, who was a prominent rancher in Arizona. Our first selection is Come Hell or High Water. Allen Jr. played high school varsity basketball. One year, Duncan had a pretty good team and managed to qualify for state finals in Chandler, a Phoenix suburb. I'd made it a priority to attend every game during the season and certainly wasn't going to miss the state tournament. The day before Al's first game, my wife Barbara, daughter Marina, and I flew up to Phoenix's Sky Harbor Airport. During the past few days, it had been raining statewide, but we managed to fly out and land between storms. I parked the Cessna at the executive airport, then rented a car at a nearby budget office. Our plan was to stay with Sandra and John that night, then drive to Al's game the next day. We arrived at the O'Connor residence in a downpour. It poured all night and into the morning. The rains extended into the White Mountains north of the city, where they melted the snowpack and sent it roaring down the Salt River all the way into Phoenix. During the night, those wild waters had washed away the bridges of some major arteries. According to the morning television news reporter, one bridge remained open. It was the one we needed to cross in order to get to Chandler and Al's afternoon game. We made sure to leave the house early enough to give ourselves extra travel time. I drove the car back the way we had come the previous day. I planned to get on the freeway near the airport. I turned on the car radio. Every 10 minutes, the announcer reminded us how slow traffic was moving. Slow was an understatement. At one point, I heard him say it could take up to 4 hours to get across town. At that rate, we were on schedule to miss the game. Come hell or high water, I was not going to miss that game. There had to be a different way to get there. Darn right there was. I had an airplane. We finally crept as far as the budget office. I turned into the parking lot, turned in the car, and we started walking the couple of blocks to the executive airport. We could fly across the river, land at the Chandler Airport, and take a taxi to the game. Or so I thought. What I didn't know was that the Salt River had run with such force that it had washed out part of the south runway, forcing air traffic control to run all planes from the north runway. We got in the Cessna and I started it up. I could see at least 20 commercial jets lined up on the one available runway, all waiting to take off. 737s to 747s. Not one small plane. I was the only fool out there. I called ground control. "Don't get in a hurry," I was told. "We're using the runway for the big boys, so it's going to be a while before we call you. Pull off to the side and we'll get to you when we can." I pulled off and we sat for a good 30 minutes. The line never shrank. Tip-off loomed closer and closer. "Okay," I thought, "time to go to Plan C." I started the plane, taxied out, and slid in between a United 707 and a Southwest 737. The pilots were so high that they remained hidden from sight. I felt like a fly on a horse's back. I radioed the tower. 6-9 Tango, ready to go in sequence. The controller was furious. "Nobody gave you taxi instructions." "Well, I'm here in line," I said. He huffed. All right, you'll depart in sequence. Be aware of wake turbulence, so get out of our airspace as fast as you can. He managed to be very professional and very disapproving at the same time. I was only too happy to get out of his airspace. We took off and flew across the river, about 1,200 feet above the ground. I knew there was a private air park outside of Chandler, a couple of miles from the basketball arena. I located the airstrip and made the landing. We were barely out of the plane when a resident pilot happened by and asked what I was doing in this private air park that didn't cater to stray planes. I said we were trying to get to a basketball game, and I'd pay him to drive us there. He became very accommodating and said sure thing, he'd do that. We arrived in time for the tip-off and watched the entire game. The team won and advanced to the finals, which they didn't win. Nevertheless, it was all very exciting. The high water had come, and I caught some hell, but it didn't matter. I got to see my son play. And that was Come Hell or High Water. This is The Dude. I occasionally attended a party hosted by Sandra and John at their Phoenix home. At one of these parties, a friend of John's, whom he had recruited as a lawyer for their firm, came up to me and said, "You're the brother who's the rancher, right?" After I acknowledged I was, this fellow said, "I was raised in Connecticut, but I'm out here now." As I soon learned, Steve had graduated with honors from Harvard Law School and eagerly accepted John's offer. Steve loved the West and all things Western. He wanted to play cowboy, but knew less than nothing about ranching. "I want you to invite me to Lazy Bee," he said. "No," I said, reciprocating his directness. I explained that sometimes Sandra would send a dude to the ranch, and it was always a big chore to babysit the dude and keep him out of trouble. I didn't need any more dudes. He wasn't insulted by my refusal. The next time I attended an O'Connor party, maybe 6 months later, Steve was there. Again, he asked me to invite him to the ranch. "No," I said. "Having somebody like you along is like having two good men gone." My comment didn't deter him, because the third time I saw him, he repeated his request. I admired his persistence. After the fourth party we found ourselves attending, I finally said okay, he could come over and ride on the roundup for a couple of days. Steve was smart enough to ask what he could bring to win favor with the cowboys. "About 4 cases of beer would do it," I said. On the appointed day, Steve arrived with 4 ice-cold cases of beer and made an instant friend of all the cowboys. He also brought his horse. "Has your horse ever been out in deep rocks?" I said. "Tomorrow we'll be rounding up in the rockiest part of the ranch." "I don't know. I've only had him in the arena." "Then you better ride one of our horses. They've been raised in rocks since day one. Your horse needs to understand the rocks." "Nah, that's okay," said Steve. "It'll be good for this old horse to be out there in the rocks. And besides, I want to ride him." "Bad mistake. But if you insist," I said. The first day out, we rounded up at Tank 2, a dirt reservoir surrounded by several 800-foot-high, solid rock mountains with cattle scattered from top to bottom. Steve and I rode up the canyon as far as we could go. "You take the right side, I'll take the left," I said. "We want to scour for cows, top to bottom, and push them down into the canyon." "Okay," he said. We split up. I knew he would have a hard time, so I made sure to take the side with more cattle. I kept an eye on him while rounding up my bunches. He'd ridden 2/3 up the mountain and was heading toward his first bunch of cows when he arrived at a large area where there had been a rock slide. The loose rocks had no soil to anchor them. If it had been me, I would have ridden above or below it, not across it, but not Steve the Dude. He had his horse start walking right across those loose rocks. When the horse got to the middle, he froze with fear. Even from the other side of the canyon, I could see the sweat and foam pouring off him. Steve kicked and spurred and shouted at him, but the horse wouldn't move. Steve got off and tried to lead him, but the horse still wouldn't move. Steve then got behind him and tried to drive him, but the horse wouldn't budge. Chuckling, I continued gathering my cattle. His horse remained in that one spot for at least a half an hour. Finally, Steve picked up rocks and started throwing them at his horse. The rock throwing dislodged other rocks. I could hear them rolling down the hill. The horse came unglued and started lunging forward. By the time he ended up across the slide on solid ground, all the cattle had turned and gone off the mountain to get away from the ruckus. Steve got back on his horse and made his way to the bottom of the canyon where I was waiting for him. He didn't know I'd seen the whole show. As he rode up, I said, "Well, Steve, how'd it go? Did you gather all the cattle off that hill?" "I don't know, but if there are any left, I'll buy them right now and take range delivery because I'm not about to climb back up there and run them off." I broke out laughing. He never offered to bring his own horse out to the ranch again, and for the next 20 years rode whatever horse I provided. Some years later, Steve returned for another roundup. We had just rounded up at Tank 5 and were driving the cattle back to Lost Lake. Steve was in the back of the herd bringing up the drag, and I was in the lead turning the cattle. I still kept a close watch on him. I could see he had his rope down and was roping at the heels of cows to keep them going. A really big bull was the slowest of all the cattle and had to be urged forward. Without warning, Steve roped the bull around the neck. Why he would choose to rope that bull around the neck, I don't know. The bull was bigger than the horse he was riding. I was furious. I was prepared to take out my pocket knife and go cut the rope before that bull got crazy mad. If that happened, there would be no way for Steve to get the rope off its neck. The bull walked about 10 more steps, and boom, he fell over. He didn't move. I knew he was dead. Steve hadn't even tightened the rope yet. I'd never seen a bull walk along in a herd and drop dead. Nor would I ever see it again. I turned my horse and headed over to the commotion, or lack thereof. The cowboys had all gathered around. There was Steve, a sheepish look on his face, the rope in his hand, and a dead bull at the feet of his horse. "Steve, why'd you kill my bull?" Steve couldn't answer. He was so flabbergasted. "What the hell were you thinking, roping a grown bull around the neck? That's as dumb an action as I've ever seen cowboying. How the hell did you plan to get that rope off his neck?" I was 99% certain he hadn't been the cause of the bull's death, but I wasn't going to let him off the hook that easily. "You're not going to like the bill I send you for the price of that bull." We later determined that the bull had eaten a weed called Goldeneye. It was spring, and Goldeneye was blooming all over the ranch. If a cow or bull grazes Goldeneye and then exerts itself, the Goldeneye can kill it. The Goldeneye had saved Steve. The story caused much cowboy gossip back at the ranch and later at the bar. Our Harvard bull-killing dude had made cowboy lore. And that was The Dude. This story is entitled The Big Burns. It was early autumn on Lazy Bee. A crew of cowboys and I were headed out to the Summit Corrals, about 8 miles from headquarters. The day before, we separated mama cows and their calves and loaded the calves on trucks so they could be delivered to a buyer. This particular morning, we were returning to the corrals to drive the cows back to headquarters first then on to nearby grazing pastures. We arrived at the group of distraught mothers just as the sun peeked over the mountains. Mournful bawls filled the air, drowning out the chatter of doves and quail. Of course, no one could tell the mamas that by now their babies were at least 500 miles away. We had quite a job to get all the heartbroken animals away from the corral. They were so intent to stay there and cry. But after a lot of hard work, we got the cows headed in the right direction and began the slow trek back to headquarters. The air grew crisper by the minute, and the grieving animals soon stirred up a shroud of dust. We had traveled about 4 miles when I noticed a large plume of smoke rising from the exact point of headquarters. Jim Brister was in the lead and came riding back to the drag.
"What do you think, Al?"
"Can't be good," I said. We went through the litany of what could be burning. The main house, the bunkhouse, one of the windmills with a wooden tower. At the moment, there was nothing anyone could do about it. We were too far away. If one of the cowboys galloped in to try and fight the fire, the cows would turn and start heading back to Summit. Besides, what could one cowboy do? So we kept pushing forward, hoping and praying that the families we left there, including my 5-year-old son, Alan Jr., and his 4-year-old cousin, Jay, were safe. For the next 90 minutes, we watched the plume grow darker and wider. Fortunately, the wind never kicked up above a breeze. At last, crew and cows crested the hill overlooking headquarters. Thank goodness no building was on fire, but flames leapt from what earlier in the morning had been 250 tons of alfalfa hay that I had spent most of the summer hauling to the ranch. It was a year's supply of feed for the horses, milk cows, and weaning calves. The pile had shrunk to my height, and the barn covering the hay had turned into smoldering cinders. I felt like one of those bawling cows. Alan Jr. and Jay were the first to come running up. Even at age 4, Jay was pretty quick on his feet.
"Big Al, Big Al," they cried. "The good news is we're okay. The bad news is that we were playing with matches and started the hay on fire."
He looked at me with big, expectant eyes. How could I holler at a 4-year-old telling the truth? I scooped up a boy in each arm and gave them a hard hug. We ended up buying more hay and cutting back on its use for the rest of the year. Considering the buildings that could have burned, it wasn't a huge disaster, just a medium-sized disaster. When disaster strikes, you do what you need to do to handle it, and then you move on. It was a lesson I put to use years later on the South Dakota ranch. I had just bought Mustang Meadows and didn't have any cattle or horses on it yet. It was summer, and my small crew and I were starting to make improvements. It was a hot, cloudless day when our neighbor, John Hippen, drove through one of our pastures to get to his adjacent pasture. His truck backfired and ignited a grass fire. Instead of getting out to fight it, he took off. Prairie grass fires can be devastating if left unchecked. The fortunate thing in that part of the world is all the ranches in the area cooperate every time there's a fire. If they see a plume of smoke, they drop what they're doing, get their equipment, and race to the fire. Our equipment consisted of a fire truck that the neighboring town of Kilgore had worn out and given to us when they bought their new truck. When I moved in, I made sure to have it serviced and filled with water so it was ready to roll. When we saw that dark smoke, we ran to the truck and raced 4 miles over the hills, the siren blasting to make sure the lizards and prairie dogs scrambled out of the way. Neighbors arrived about the same time, some with shovels, some with willing bodies, one with a water tank in the back of his pickup. A large area of pasture was already blackened. The prairie fire can go 100 yards in 2 minutes. The strong winds blowing at us didn't help. There were about 8 of us, and we had to fight like hell. For a bit there, Things teetered on who would win, the fire or us. We eventually contained the fire after it burned about 30 acres. A year later, a big grass fire started west of us and scorched 100,000 acres of good grassland. Fire trucks from 100 miles away came in to fight that one. They emptied their tanks and had to go refill I don't know how many times. Those were some long, hot hours for those firefighters. My foreman happened to go into a bar not too long after our fire. Who was there but Hippen, and what was he talking about but how his truck started a fire that burned a bunch of prairie grass? Hippen never explained why he didn't get out of his truck, and my foreman never confronted him. It didn't seem worth fighting over, especially since the fire had been put out and the grass would get around to growing soon enough. But Hippen, I'm telling you now, if you're still up there, alive and well, you owe us one. That was The Big Burns. And now we will read Almost Famous. I was carrying groceries from my Suburban to the double-wide trailer I lived in on Mustang Meadows Ranch. The wild turkeys marched past me, heading toward the ranch road as if setting out on a summer vacation. One of these days I'll follow them, I thought. Maybe I'll learn something. Right then I needed to answer the phone ringing inside. Hello, I said. The screen door slammed right as the person said his name. Sorry, I didn't hear you. This is Kevin Costner calling. There was a pause. Are you the person to speak to about the Wild Horse Sanctuary? Yeah, I am. I'm Alan Day. If you have a minute, Mr. Day, I'd like to talk to you about your sanctuary. I'm working on a project involving a lot of horses, and you might be of help. I didn't know anyone named Kevin Costner, but said fine. I'd be happy to listen. He proceeded to explain that he was an actor and was directing a movie set in South Dakota. It had to do with Indians and would be filmed on the prairie. He asked a lot of questions about the location of the ranch and its layout, then peppered me with questions about the horses. Can you control your horses enough to be able to film them? He asked. You betcha, I said, and babbled about how we had trained the horses and could move them in one herd from pasture to pasture. They're most cooperative, I said, ever the proud parent. Costner said, several of the scenes involve an Indian camp and a river and a large group of horses that will be used as their remuda. Well, we have the Little White River that runs through 5 miles of the ranch, I said. I'd like to send you a copy of my script and have you read it, said Costner. See if you can envision the movie being shot on your ranch. I agreed. We hung up. I walked back outside. The turkeys were fat-rumped specks waddling up the last hill of the road before it turned out of sight. A funny feeling settled over me. That had been a strange conversation. I never went to the movies. What if this guy wasn't an actor? What if I was being flim-flammed by a hustler? I went back inside and called my buddy Mike Berry in Tucson, the biggest movie buff I knew. Have you ever heard of an actor by the name of Kevin Coogan? I asked him. Kevin Coogan? Nah, never heard of him. Well, some guy named Kevin Coogan just called me and insinuated he's some big movie star and is looking to shoot a film up here on the ranch. I'm wondering if he's for real or giving me a line. Kevin Coogan, huh? You sure that's his name? Asked Mike. Well, yeah, I'm pretty sure, I said, not feeling so sure. Names and I have never gotten along well. I heard a creak like a chair leaning back, then a hollow slap like a hand hitting something. You wouldn't by chance mean Kevin Costner? Yeah, I might mean Kevin Costner. So I misplaced a few letters. Mike assured me that he was the real deal,
and he advised me to rent Field of Dreams and Silverado. I told him I'd have to get a VCR first. A few days later, FedEx delivered a box to the ranch. I settled in at my desk, took my pocket knife, slit the end of the box, and slid out a slim black binder filled with a little over 100 pages of paper. I flipped it open to the first page, Dances with Wolves, written by Michael Blake. Every free moment that weekend, I picked up the screenplay. By Sunday night, I had finished it. Even with its foreign notations and directions, the story gripped me. I never read a script and didn't have anything to compare it to, but I could envision it being shot on Mustang Meadows Ranch, especially the scenes of an Indian camp on the banks of a river with a horse herd nearby. Costner called midweek, and I shared my thoughts. "If you don't mind, I'd like to come see your ranch and the horses," he said. "Works with me," I said. 2 weeks later, I landed my 182 Cessna at the Front Range Airport in Denver and went into the pilot's lounge where Costner and I had arranged to meet. He was bringing his producer, Jim Wilson, with him. About 10 people were seated at tables. 2 guys in jeans and cowboy boots sat at one. They were about the same age, both with sandy brown hair and athletic. I wasn't sure who Costner was and who was Wilson, so I introduced myself. Costner sat next to me in the plane, and Wilson took the back seat. Costner mentioned that he had never flown in such a small airplane. We taxied out to the run-up area. I picked up my well-used checklist from the dash. I had it memorized, but didn't want to appear too nonchalant about piloting, so went down the list with my finger, checking the steering wheel for free action, cycled the prop, checked oil pressure, checked the mags. Costner leaned around the seat and said to Wilson, "This guy has to read the instruction manual before taking off." Great. I had a comedian and actor on board. During the 75-minute flight, Costner told me more about his vision for the movie. It would be his first effort directing. He was fully confident that he could do it. But Hollywood questioned his ability and refused to put up the money. Eventually, he found funding from an investor in Italy. I well knew the language of naysayers. It has a limited vocabulary of words like never, can't, and crazy. Phrases like no way, what's he thinking, and the ultimate wet blanket, it's impossible. If I had taken the cynic's advice to heart, I might own a ranch in South Dakota, but the only horses on it would be a half dozen saddle horses. Paddling upstream seemed to be my role in life, and Costner seemed to be sharing the same canoe. We landed in Valentine, Nebraska, and hopped in the Suburban. An hour later, I turned the truck off the state road and drove under the sign for Mustang Meadows Ranch. The sun sat like a ripe peach over the horizon, and the hills glowed yellow, as if showing off for Hollywood. "This is how I envisioned it," Costner said. "This light is perfect." I pulled up to my double-wide trailer. "Guys, we'll have to wait to see the horses in the ranch until tomorrow," I said. "How about if I grill some steaks and we have a little dinner?" "Suits us just fine," said Kevin. They grabbed their duffel bags, and I showed them where they would be staying in the double wide. We made steaks and made a dent in a fifth of scotch. Kevin shared his background and his struggle getting into the movie business. He had an easygoing, affable manner about him. The next day was perfect, a brisk breeze, but not enough to dislodge a hat, the greens of early summer, a warm sun. The three of us set out in the Suburban to explore the ranch. Costner asked many questions. How far was it to hotels and restaurants? Where were the biggest hills on the ranch? Where was the little white river? It's just over the hill, I said. He said, good, then let's park here. I want to see the view as we crest the hill on foot. At the top of the hill, we stopped. He explained this was the scene the cameras would reveal. He formed his hands into a lens and put it up to his eye. Perfect, I thought I heard him whisper. We spent the rest of the morning in the area. Would he have to get permission to film from anyone but me? No, I owned the property. Could he build a camp here? Yeah, no problem. How wide was the river? Do you think these trees work in the background? He was gathering information and making serious decisions. I knew the drill. The ranch seemed to be calling to him. The location, however, was not. Most of the filming is done in the early morning and late afternoon when the light is best. Having a crew stay at a hotel 2 hours from the shoot would require everyone to get up at about 3 a.m. to start doing makeup, load gear, eat breakfast, then drive. That's early, even for a cowboy. It was mid-afternoon when we pulled into the cemetery pasture, named for the Indian burial mounds on it. I stopped the Suburban on a hilltop. Down below, 1,500 Mustangs grazed. They had become accustomed to the Suburban by now and didn't pay us much attention. A pheasant cock was far less amused by our presence. The bird started running around one of the mounds, squawking. It must have amused Costner, because he got out of the car and started chasing it and doing the funky chicken dance. Maybe he had concentrated so hard by the little white that he needed an outlet. Jim and I sat in the truck, while Costner and the pheasant cock ran around. The wind was blowing in the direction of the horses and carried their noisy conversation right into the sensitive ears of the Mustangs. A few horses started pawing the ground. Their heads alert, their tails swishing, they began to vibrate like a hive of irritated bees. Costner and the bird kept up their antics. A few of the horses started to run, a signal to the others to pay attention and to get moving. Within a minute, the herd was stampeding. Jim and I got out of the truck to watch.
Kevin, look what you've done, yelled Jim.
Costner stopped and looked at the horses. Oh, man, he said. What happened to them? The herd circled the entire pasture, then slowed down once they didn't hear any more grating noise. I wished that I had had a camera to capture the scene. The next day, I flew the boys up to Pier to meet with a fellow who owned a herd of buffalo. By then, Costner knew he loved the land, the river, the horses, but he was discouraged about the logistics. He said that he would let me know if they would be using the ranch. He was a man with a job to do, and was taking that job seriously and throwing himself into it. If my ranch fit into that job, then so be it. If not, that was okay too. He said he'd love to come back and do some horseback riding and hunting on the ranch. I told him the door was always open. A few weeks later, Costner called. He'd found a site about 15 miles outside of Rapid City, South Dakota. It would be better for the crew, but he appreciated being able to see Mustang Meadows Ranch. Sure was a gorgeous place. I wished him luck on his project. In the end, I was glad that the movie wasn't shot on the ranch. A lot of wheels and feet would have trampled the sandy soil in a small area. Surely, the grass would have been damaged, and who knows what else. I'd been concerned about that, but reasoned that the land would recover. The movie's incredible popularity resulted in curious people visiting the site where it had been shot. They came at all hours of the day and all days. The trampling of their feet and the ruts left by their vehicles would have seriously damaged the fragile vegetation and created blowouts, giant potholes formed by high winds. I would be to blame. I figured it was just better to enjoy the movie on the silver screen with its scenes of beautiful rolling prairie. That was Almost Famous. Now we will read from a section of the book entitled On Listening, and the subtitle reads, Never Miss a Good Chance to Shut Up. This is Cloud Seeding. I was sitting in my office in late July, enduring one of the harshest, ugliest droughts we had ever experienced on Lazy Bee. Not one drop of rain had fallen during the past 9 months. Since the grass hadn't greened up with protein, we had to haul feed to keep the cows from starving to death. I was wondering what I had done wrong to cause God to punish me. Out of frustration, I picked up the phone and called my sister, Sandra, who at the time was serving as the majority leader in the state Senate. Sandra answered the phone. "Do you know how dry it is here on the ranch?" I said. "Yes," she said. "It's that dry all over Arizona, getting close to a crisis." "Well, why don't you do something about it?" I said, only half joking. Sandra was one of the world's best problem solvers. She said, "What do you want me to do?" Out of nowhere popped an idea. "How about starting a cloud seeding program to make it rain?" "My goodness," said Sandra. "Now, that's a thought. Let me see what I can do." I hung up feeling better at having dumped my load of angst onto her shoulders. I didn't give our conversation another thought. About a week later, Sandra called back. After checking around various places in Washington, D.C., she was directed to the Office of Emergency Preparedness. She spoke to a General Lincoln, the head of the office, who was quite responsive to my suggestion. He asked if it were dry on the Indian reservations. Sandra said yes, very dry. He told her that if she could get the Indian tribal leaders to request federal assistance with cloud seeding, the federal coffers would open and at least money would rain down on Arizona. Sandra immediately called Peter McDonald, the chairman of the Navajo Nation, and asked him if he would like to get some rain made. He said absolutely yes. A contract was issued, and Safford, Arizona, a town 45 miles west of Lazy Bee, became Cloud Seeding Central. I was overwhelmed with the response. It was incredible. You make a phone call, bitch a little bit to your sister, and boom, life changes. Or so you think. If the government could seed above the reservations, I was pretty sure that they could seed above the rest of the state. I jumped into my Cessna and flew over to Safford Airport to check things out. Three airplanes were parked in a row. I could see the silver iodide flares mounted under the wings, pointed backward like small missiles. Silver iodide helps make rain by acting as a nucleating agent. When silver iodide molecules make their way into clouds, water molecules attach to them, and, when heavy enough, they fall out of the clouds as rain. It didn't take long to locate the crews lounging in the hangar doing what pilots do, talking, flying, and drinking coffee. They were happy to greet a new face, and only too happy to tell me that they were professional cloud seeders and were there on a government contract. "But you can't make rain out of blue sky," one said. They were hoping for moisture and clouds to invade the area within the next week. I said, "When that happens, my ranch is due east. Can you make sure to fly over it and let loose some of your magic flares?" Much to my surprise, they quickly turned me down. Their contract with the government called for them to fly only in Arizona and no closer than 30 miles to any of the state's borders. That meant they would miss Lazy Bee entirely. I argued and begged for them to make an exception. "It's federal money," I pointed out, and reminded them that I was the one who had inspired their contract. They were kind and patient to this impatient cowboy, but firm in their position. I asked why some knucklehead bureaucrat in Washington had drawn up the contract that way. They suggested I call my senator and ask. I went home frustrated, but determined. The next day, I returned to refresh the argument. They again turned me down. I again was undeterred. By the third day, they had had about enough of me. One of the pilots said, "Why don't you seed the clouds yourself? That's your 182, right?" I nodded. "All you need to do is make a removable bracket and bolt it onto the landing gear," he said. "We can tell you where to go to get the flares and how to use them." My mind exploded with possibility. I was so desperate for rain. "Spell it out and don't miss a detail," I said. Per their suggestion, I ordered the flares from Olin Matheson Chemical in St. Louis, Missouri, and bought a car battery. I built a bracket in my shop, then bolted it onto my plane's landing gear. The flares soon arrived. After I secured them in the bracket, I threaded the two lead wires from each flare through the door and into the cockpit where I had stored the car battery. In order to fire the flares, I would need to touch the wires to the battery's terminals. I would do this while the plane circled at the base of a targeted cloud. The flare would burn for 8 minutes and release its silver iodide crystals. The cloud's updraft would suck up the silver iodide. The pilots had instructed me to seed cumulus clouds with a minimum updraft of 500 feet per minute. The seeded clouds might rain, or they might not. Seeding a cloud that was about to rain could double or triple the amount of rainfall. By the time I was ready to seed, moisture had moved into Arizona and cumulus clouds were forming. I soon discovered that flying at 12,500 feet at the base of a big cumulus cloud was not your everyday flying experience. It was turbulent to the extreme. Sometimes it felt like I was riding a bucking horse. I always strapped myself in with a shoulder harness, but I had to unstrap it to climb in the back seat to fire the flares. The plane would buck so much it would throw me all over the cockpit. I became frightened that I might hit my head and get knocked out. I flew 8 minutes under a cloud candidate, and when the flare stopped burning, I scouted out another cloud. The bracket held 6 flares, so I could seed 6 clouds. Quite often, a thunderstorm would start within minutes of seeding a cloud. On a number of occasions, when I descended from the base of a cloud to the ranch, which took about 16 minutes, 2 inches of water would already be covering the runway, all from the rain I had just initiated. I would be laughing and screaming and cheering as I hydroplaned to a stop. I tried seeding all types of clouds and pretty quickly learned which clouds were ripe and which weren't ready. If I seeded one that wasn't ready, in about 4 minutes, it would disappear. Poof. Gone. I started feeling godlike. One time, I approached a very large cloud with a very dark bottom. As I flew under it, I hit a huge updraft. My gauge indicated it was a 3,000-foot-a-minute updraft. Within seconds, I was sucked up into the middle of the cloud, a place I really didn't want to be. Total fog, rain, no sense of direction. It might have been cold, but I was sweating so much I wouldn't have known. I had no idea where I was going. I tried to keep my cool, pointed the nose down, and started the power dive. The airspeed indicator quickly jumped to the red line. If I exceeded that line, I was in danger of shaking off a wing, especially in turbulence. And believe me, I was in heavy-duty turbulence. I kept thinking, "Kiss your ass goodbye, cowboy." Fortunately, The power dive brought me out of the bottom of that cloud. I never bothered to tell my wife or family about my near miss. Twice, I invited people to accompany me. One was my foreman, Cole, who flew with me quite a little, and the other was a friend. Both of them had the exact same reaction when we landed. That was an exhilarating ride, Al. But if you need somebody to go with you next time, please don't call me. Every morning, I worked on the ranch and watched the clouds develop. I planned my day so that I was available for seeding in the afternoon when the clouds typically rained. My work became vastly easier because green grass began sprouting everywhere. The cows had smiles on their faces. They were putting on weight, and all of our reservoirs were full of water. In fact, rain was greening the entire area, not just Lazy Bee. At the end of the season, our records showed a 50% greater than normal rainfall. I will always believe that my seeding caused at least some of that increase, if not all. I went into the fall with a great feeling of success and happiness and ordered another case of flares for the next summer. Cumulus clouds only appeared during the monsoon season, not during winter. I was afraid to tell anyone about my venture because I didn't know how many rules and laws I was breaking by being a wildcat seeder. Plus, I figured people would be funny with their reactions. Some people might say I washed out their reservoir. Others might say I stole the rain that would have come to their ranch. I didn't want to face such accusations, so I kept my success to myself. The following summer, I was ready to seed well before the summer rains that usually began around the 1st of July and extended through September. I seeded all summer with spectacular success. The danger was no different. Flying at 12,500 feet gave me a headache every time. For whatever reason, I never bought oxygen or a helmet, even though I was still getting bounced around in the cockpit. After landing, I'd have to lie down for 2 hours. By the 1st of October, rainfall on the ranch was 70% above normal. What an amazing summer it was! I felt as if I had created a new dimension to Arizona ranching and assumed that was a good thing. Then, one day at the beginning of October, clouds appeared sooner than usual. I watched with glee as they seemed to grow and multiply before my eyes. It was getting to look like the best day I'd ever seen for possible rains. I drove up early to the hangar and had just opened the pickup door to get out and go to the plane when a voice spoke to me. "Don't fly today," it said. I looked around, trying to determine where the voice came from. I didn't think anyone was within 2 miles of my hangar. The voice repeated, "Don't fly today." I was dumbfounded. In all my life, I'd never heard a voice without a body speak to me. It repeated itself again. Was I hearing the voice through my ears or hearing it through my mind? I couldn't determine. It repeated the same words at least 6 more times. I started arguing with it out loud. "But this looks like the best day ever to seed," I said. "Don't fly today," it said. I began to feel quite troubled. Should I pay attention to this or not? I rationalized with myself. "We've had a fabulous summer already. The tanks are full. The grass is green. The cows are fat. We're approaching fall with the ranch in the best shape it has ever been. Maybe I don't really need to seed." I shut the pickup door and drove back to the headquarters. That afternoon, it rained so hard that the Gila River flooded, and the flood was so severe that it washed part of the town of Duncan away, including the elementary school. 3 people drowned,
and the area suffered multi-million dollar damage. I had a very strong reaction to all of those events. My main reaction was, "Thank you, God, for looking over me and persuading me not to fly. I'll always believe that if I'd flown, the flood might have been worse and more people might have died. I would have carried that guilt to my grave." I never seeded again. It became clear that I had been playing God, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I'm not particularly religious, but some force had my back and had been kind to me. When I sold the ranch, I still had half a case of flares. I didn't tell the buyers what they were for. I have no idea if they remain there, but I'm pretty certain they'll never be used. And that's just fine by me. That was Cloud Seeding. Now we will read Hung Up. The son of the boss sometimes gets to thinking he's bigger than he should be, and once in a while needs to be taken down a notch or two. I was no exception. We had a cowboy, Gene Johnson, who worked for us for a while, along with three of his brothers. Gene had a lot of good common sense. He didn't need a cocky six-year-old to start telling him what to do, but one day, I did just that. "I'm not doing that," said Gene. I said, "You better do it, or I'll tell my dad and he'll fire you." Gene wasn't a bit intimidated. "If you don't shut up, I'll hang you by your belt loop on the bunkhouse hook, and I'll drive off and leave you hanging." "You wouldn't dare," said the sassy kid. Gene did dare. He picked me up, walked over to the bunkhouse, lifted the water bag off the big hook, and hung me up instead. I kicked and screamed who knows what as he drove off. When my belt loop finally broke and I dropped to the floor, I thought about going to Da and telling him what had happened, but my good sense told me I better not. I better just keep quiet about things. My dad probably would have said, "Gene should have hung you up even more securely." Years later, I was hung up again, but in a different way. I was still cocky, but not very sassy. I was a student at the University of Arizona heading home to the ranch for Christmas vacation. The freeways hadn't been built yet, so I was driving the two-lane highway that went through downtown Benson, a town about 45 miles east of Tucson. The local policeman in Benson had the identical car to mine, except that mine was souped up a bit. It was a dark blue 57 Chevy. I had bought it back in high school and done a little work on it. Every time I saw that Benson police car, I would smirk and think I could outrun him. It was a sleepy Sunday morning when I hit downtown Benson and saw the police car parked beside the road. Without even thinking, I hit second gear and burned a strip of rubber right in front of that cop. It was an outright invitation to chase me. I was pretty sure that I could outrun him. It worked. Here he came. I went screaming through the east side of Benson, under the railroad tracks and up the other side. I was doing over 100 when who should appear beside the road but a state trooper. The state police at that time drove a big souped-up Oldsmobile, a car much faster than my car. The trooper caught up to me in a flash and wrote me a ticket for reckless driving. He said, "You have to go back and face the judge right now." I had no choice, Sunday or not. I followed the state trooper back to Benson. The judge's office was in his home, so I waited in the driveway for him to get out of church. He was a nice man and asked me to explain what the hell I had been doing driving over 100 miles per hour through Benson on a Sunday morning. I owned up to doing it and didn't offer an excuse. "The fine's $120, he said. "I don't have that much money, sir." He looked at my driver's license. "Are you from Duncan?" "Yes, sir,"
I said. What are you doing, Duncan? I said I lived on a ranch. Will you be working over Christmas? Yes, sir, I replied. Every day. Will you hold on to your earnings and bring me the money on your way back to school? I said, yes, sir. Thank you, sir. A month later, I stopped back at the judge's home and handed him the money. From that point on, I kept that old Chevy under 100 miles per hour. And as far as I know, the judge never told anyone my story. And neither did I. And that was Hung Up. Thank you for joining us once again for Western Short Stories, these being from the book Cowboy Up, Life Lessons from Lazy Bee by H. Allen Day. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sound of Arizona.
That old cowpoke went riding out one dark and winded day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw. My head.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.